just over a week ago in one of China's largest cities. We met with a 76-year-old man who had spent 21 years of his life in a prison of the People's Republic of China because he is a Christian. The oldest of his six children was 17 when he was first arrested, 38 years old when his father saw him again. The youngest of the children was six, and therefore 27 years without a father, from young childhood to well into adulthood. It is really an extraordinary thing to think of a man being arrested for being a Christian and so long incarcerated for it in a country that professedly would claim to have freedom of religion. But understand that he was not arrested, nor condemned, nor imprisoned, so much for what he believed as for what he did. It is because he acted like a Christian that they knew he was a Christian, and so that's why they arrested him and put him in prison. After all, there's no way that it can be known what someone believes in a heart or silent prayers that we utter. It is only as we behave on the outside that it's possible ever to identify us as Christians. That runs somewhat counter to the defective definition of Christianity that we often describe here in America, one in which we say that all that really matters is what you believe. As long as you believe the right things on the inside, in your head and in your heart, then it really doesn't matter too much what one does. It is far more a matter of belief than it is a matter of behavior. But in China, and in the Bible, and in other points and times in history, it has been quite a clear thing that behavior is just as important, some would say even more important, than belief. After all, Jesus never said, "By their beliefs you will know that they are my disciples." But rather Jesus taught that Christians shall be known by their behavior, and specifically by our love for one another. In the New Testament book of John, Jesus is quoted as saying, "A new commandment I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." That seems clear enough, except there are those who would say, "Yeah, sure, but what does it mean to love?" After all, there's a whole myriad of descriptions and definitions of love. There are those who have written poetry about it. There are those who even come up with contradictory explanations of what love really is. And again, in our society, we tend to describe love primarily as an emotion and not primarily as a behavior. And so the Bible anticipated the question, what is this love by which we are to be known as Christians? And gives the answer in the New Testament letter of 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16, saying, "This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us." Now, what Jesus did is well known. The cross is well known. You see it on the tops of steeples. You see it on jewelry that people wear. It's well known in our culture and, frankly, pretty well known outside of our culture, even where people are not Christians, at least the basic that the cross is the symbol of what Christianity is all about. We, within a Christian context, should and claim to know well that Jesus voluntarily gave up his life for the benefit of others, that he who did not need to die volunteered and chose to die and did so as a substitute for others. It's an amazing thing, really an extraordinary story, unparalleled, especially when we understand that this Jesus who so died on the cross was and is both God and man, both divine and human at the same time. That is very important for us in understanding the arithmetic of salvation. For in our arithmetic, we would say one person can substitute for one person. So if I were to be so magnanimous as to volunteer to take the prison term of someone else And if the courts were allowed that to take place, then I might go to jail in the place of one other man. But of course, it would be unacceptable by either our system of justice or by our sense of arithmetic for me as one person to go for all of those who are in all of the prisons of this country. We would say, you just can't do that. One for one, maybe, but not one for all. That simply doesn't work. But it does work when it comes to Jesus, because he is God, and God is not finite, God is infinite. There is no limit to him. And so the calculation is not made by human arithmetic, but by the arithmetic of heaven. And so he is the one and the only one who can possibly substitute for the all, for the many. However, were he only God, he would even be inadequate in his infinity. But the Son of God chose to become human. And in so doing, he became like us and so may be our substitute in taking care of this problem that we have with sin. But of course, if he had his own sin, the best he would be able to do would be to take care of that and pay the price for that which he had done that was wrong. And yet the Bible clearly teaches that he was and is without sin and human, therefore qualified to be a substitute for we sinners. Put it all together, and you have Jesus Christ, God and man, infinite and human, who volunteered to be a substitute to take our place, and that's love. That he who didn't need to do it, did. But why is this love? Well, we have been studying in this letter in the New Testament called the first letter of John for a long time, and with some interruptions, we have even been a long time in the third chapter, and it was never intended to be broken up into pieces like this. It was anticipated that, like any letter, it would be read at a single sitting. And so, because of this, it's important for us to at least for a moment review. And perhaps you recall that earlier in this letter, and in this particular chapter of it, there was reference made to Cain, the man, the first man to kill another man, Cain who killed his brother Abel, that he murdered him out of a combination of envy and anger, and that here he is brought forth as the ultimate example of what is hate when someone would murder a brother. And he is here contrasted with Jesus. Jesus, who sacrificed his own life for the benefit of others and specifically of all of us. It is out of that contrast that the biblical definitions of hate and love come. That hate is taking what belongs to somebody else for our benefit. And that love is taking what belongs to us for another's benefit. When you understand those definitions, you begin to see how they are applied from the Ten Commandments on through the rest of the Old Testament and the New. That stealing, adultery, lying, abortion, are hate. Because in each instance, they are taking that which belongs to someone else for the benefit of the taker. And by contrast, kindness and generosity and patience and charity are all love. Because in each of those instances, it is taking what belongs to me and giving it to someone else. Now, God tells us all this not so that we will admire the information, but he tells us all this so that we will follow the example. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. One of the most striking differences between Christianity and the other major religions of the world is that they present a God who tells us what to do, whereas Christianity presents a God who shows us what to do. I think of the teachers and the bosses that I have had through my own life. I think that while there are many contrasts, one of the most marked is the difference in style of communication. For I, like you, have had teachers who tell and teachers who show. Bosses who order and bosses who demonstrate. And I suspect that I, like you, learn far more quickly and benefit far more greatly by those who demonstrate and show me how to do it. Whether it's the process of learning history or the process of building a piece of furniture or driving a car, whatever it may be, there is something highly beneficial to not just having words, but having actions. So that you can follow the coach, you can follow the teacher, you can follow the boss, you can follow the person who shows you how to do it. And Christianity is unique in that Jesus is the one who showed us what it means to be a Christian, in that he demonstrated for us the love that is the hallmark of all Christians and of all Christianity. The great principle is the principle of self-sacrifice, that we lay down our lives for others, that we do what Jesus did, and that is to die. To die for someone else, to die for another Christian. I think there are a lot of hard sayings in the Bible. I find that when I read the Bible for myself, sometimes I trip, if not just about choke, over some of the words. Some of them are very abrupt, and if taken literally, they seem to be impossible or almost so. I likewise find as a teacher of what the Bible has to say that some of them are words that I would choose to avoid rather than to teach. They don't seem to quite make sense, or they seem impossible in their fulfillment. And surely this statement in 1 John 3:16 has got to be counted among them. For it says that to be a Christian is to love as Jesus loved and to lay down one's life for another. Now, if that is understood as it seems to appear here on face value, it is to say that any of us who are not willing or, in fact, have not given our lives for someone else are not Christians. And how does that fit for who knows anyone who has ever sacrificed life itself for somebody else? My, I find it difficult to give up my place in line for somebody else, much less my life for somebody else. I find too often that I'm a rather greedy person, that I'm more interested in accumulation than I am interested in generosity. I find that when I look at other people who have less, that I am prone to excuse myself by describing their character and their behavior in a rather derogatory way, somehow implying that I deserve to have more and somehow implying that they deserve to have less. And yet, did you know that there are Christians who are literally following Jesus in what this here says, literally following his example in our world today, that they are in places where there is a religious monopoly, such as Iran and Iraq, or where there is political totalitarianism, countries like North Korea and China and Albania, where people are actually dying for the sake of other Christians? If possible, think of yourself in a circumstance where the state police arrive at your home and ask you for a list of who the other believers are and where they can be found. And you recognize that if you give that information, in all probability, it will cost the lives of those brothers and sisters in Christ. And on the other hand, if you refuse, that it will cost you your life. I've thought about how I would respond to that type of challenge. I would like to think that I would be willing to die for you, for someone else. Although I can hardly imagine in the freedoms of this country and the circumstances in which we live ever facing such a dilemma. But just because you and I don't have to face it does not mean that others are not facing it. People by the tens of thousands, in some cases by the hundreds of thousands, the estimate is an average of 330,000 people die every year around the world simply because they are Christians. Now, to die for another is, as you can well imagine, a very great sacrifice. But to follow the example of Jesus Christ is always a very great privilege. And I find that those who report their testimony of a willingness to die for others couch their terms not in sacrifice, but in privilege. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. Yes, except you know that practically speaking, that's quite unlikely. It would be the rarest of instances. I can't even think of an example in our country Can't even think of a single example of where someone has had to do it or where someone is likely to have to do such an exceptional, extraordinary thing, even if we were willing. And so because of that, the Bible writes on, having already stated the great principle of self-sacrifice, to be like Jesus and going all the way to give one's life for another, it moves on to the general, the normal practice of self-sacrifice, having in mind 1990 in our state of Minnesota. In 1 John 3:17, we are told that if anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need, but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? So that while dying for another is not likely to apply to any of us who are here, seeing another person who has material need is likely to happen to every single one of us who is here. And the Bible, as I understand it, here teaches then that the proof that we are Christians is that we love those with less and give up some of what we have for their benefit instead of for ours. It's back to that definition of love, that love is giving what belongs to us for the benefit of someone else. Now, it's very important that we understand here concretely what is being addressed, and not just theoretically and abstractly. The Bible here is not talking about contributions that are made into an offering plate in a church like Wooddale Church. It is not referring to money that we give to support missionaries like the Wrights to go to Japan. It does not refer to contributions to underwrite the program of a local church or to build a building. All of those things are good and they're important. In my view, they are necessary to do the work that God has called us to do. It is somehow understood within the Bible that that is an integral part of what the Christian life and the Christian community is all about. But that is not the least in mind here in 1 John chapter 3. Rather, it's talking not about giving $100 or $100,000 to Wooddale Church, but rather is talking about giving something to specific individuals who don't have another way of getting it other than our caring for them. It refers to you or to me seeing an unemployed Christian within our fellowship and giving some direct help. Or it may be the recognition that there's a single mom who's up against it financially and writing a check for her benefit, or better yet, getting a money order or cash and sending her $500 that will absolutely change the way she lives, and simply doing it as an expression of the love of Jesus Christ, even though she'll never know who the donor may be. Or it's giving a car to someone who needs it. And that would be a great sacrifice. If I have a car and is to be traded in on a new vehicle, and I'm counting on the equity of that, to actually turn the title of that car and physically give it to someone else just because they need transportation. Or it's paying for someone's medical bills who can't pay them. And maybe because of that is having difficulty getting continuing medical care. Maybe it's somehow almost clandestinely in a conversation with that hurting individual, finding out who the physician is, and then without telling the person, sending a check to be applied to that person's account. Or maybe if you are a frequent flyer and you've accumulated enough miles that you have free tickets that you've been saving up to take a special vacation to maybe some exotic place, although I have always thought it strange that people who have to fly all the time should be rewarded with more flights. But if, just in case you've got them and you've been saving them, what would you think of looking at a family that doesn't have the means to ever take a vacation and giving those frequent flyer tickets away? No strings attached, simply as an expression of the love of Jesus Christ. What about giving money or things or whatever you have, not with the expectation that it be tax deductible, but as an expression of the love of Jesus Christ? He who gave his life for us has called upon us to give tangibly to other people who have need. We don't have to give our lives. We can give far less. Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth. You see, love isn't what we say. It's too bad that we so often think that. Oh, I'm not saying that words are unimportant. Words are very important. But it's too easy to say, I love you. It's too easy to say, I love humankind in general, and it is quite another matter to sacrificially and materially give something to someone who has less. The Bible here teaches that proof that we belong to Jesus is the love that we show to others through specific acts of self-sacrifice to specific people. Now, such love in action not only gives to us the proof that we're Christians, but, as we read on in verses 19 and 20, also gives to us a very special peace. 1 John 3:19 and 20, I think, is added for those good Christians who are prone to worry, those who are here today who have sensitive hearts, who read some words like this or hear such talk as you have just listened to, and are pricked in the conscience to the point of saying, wait a minute, I've never given away a car or an airplane ticket or sent money anonymously to someone, at least it's not been for a very long time, or it's been comparatively little that I have done for the benefit of others as an expression of the love of Christ. Perhaps then you're saying that I'm not really a Christian at all, that I've only said the words, but I haven't had the behavior that would back it up. I have not demonstrated to God or to anyone else that I'm really a disciple of Jesus Christ. It is to such sensitive hearts that these next words are given. Words that are communicating that there's no need to worry. For all true Christians need to do is check the record. Go back and reread your diary. Or get out your checkbook and look at the stubs or follow the log. Go back to the first of the year and look. Perhaps there to find examples that have been forgotten. And so there is some Christian who comes and reads these words and says, well, that makes me worried. I'm not sure of what I've done. And then when checking the record, he or she finds a checkbook entry on the 5th of January of a $200 gift for the children of the sub-Sahara of Africa, given to some organization that provides relief and development to that part of the world. And then a recollection that on the 12th of February there was an offer at the company to work overtime. And here is a person who wanted the overtime and wanted the time and a half pay, but recognized that if the overtime was not accepted, that Joe would probably get it, and Joe's behind in his mortgage payment, and he can use the money far better. And so here's a Christian who declined the overtime without ever mentioning that it was for Joe's benefit, but simply said to the manager, no, I'm not going to be able to do it. I think I'll decline this time. Why don't you just give the extra overtime to Joe? Or in checking the record further, on the 7th of March, that was the date when this Christian put $50 into a plain envelope, wrapped it in a piece of white paper. No explanation, no note, no return address. And mailed it to Frank and Sally because she's been sick and because he's been out of work. Or the Christian who was reminded by a review of the vacation records at the office that the 28th of April was taken as a vacation day to help old Mrs. Leverson paint the living room in her house in Bloomington, or the 10th of May when that family was invited over for dinner that no one else seems to have taken the trouble to befriend. This, then, is how we know that we belong to the truth and how we set our hearts at rest in his presence whenever our hearts condemn us. Christians, no need to worry. Just check the record of love in action. And it is that record that gives proof and gives peace. Yet you say that begs yet another question. Because I've had some special circumstances. I've had difficulty myself with employment. I too have been ill. Since the first of the year has been the most difficult year in any year that I can remember in the last 20. It's been a hard time for me, and because of that, I perhaps have been insensitive to the needs of others, perhaps blinded to them, and far less generous and self-sacrificial than I ought to have been. I didn't have $50 for Frank or Sally. I didn't know that there was still a continuing famine in Africa. I guess you'd say they're kind of excuses. But are they? You see, the next verse, verse 20, is for you. God is greater than our hearts, even if our hearts are condemning us because we haven't done all we should do. God is greater than our hearts, and He knows everything. God knows our health. God knows our checkbook balance. God knows our level of sensitivity. God knows everything there is to know about every circumstance about every one of us. And it is that God who knows where we're coming from, what we have, and what we see. He is the God who, in love, takes a look at our hearts. He knows it all. And He is the God then that gives the reassurance to us that the special circumstances are well within His knowledge. I conclude with one final word. It is that while this appears to be a difficult part of the Bible, I have to tell you that I kind of like it. I like it because I've seen it. I mean, I've seen what's here described happen. And I haven't just seen it once or twice. I've seen it 1,000 times. And I wish I kept the record because my guess is I've seen it 10,000 times. I've seen it in Christians in lots of places. I think I have nowhere seen it more than in the Christians of this church. Stories, scores and scores and scores of stories multiplied one upon the other, of people who sometimes secretly, sometimes openly, have given self-sacrificially for others in their need. Stories, frankly, too private to tell. It's too bad. It's not the kind of thing that you write up in a church publication and mail out. It's not the type of thing that either the giver or the recipient feels very comfortable standing up here in front of everybody and talking about. I, for myself, have most often heard the stories from those who have been on the receiving end, who have said that they have received money from some anonymous donor or some special encouragement or help in their time of greatest need. Often they have come and asked me because they didn't know where it came from and they wanted to know if I knew. I've told them to simply count it as coming from God, but the truth is that there are all kinds of Christian people who demonstrate the proof and get the peace simply because they follow the example of Jesus Christ, who knew what it meant to love when He gave Himself sacrificially for us, and knew what He meant when He said that we would be known as His disciples when we give self-sacrificially for the benefit of others. It's genuine love. I see it. It's genuine sacrifice. I'm enthralled by it. It's genuine Christianity. And so if I have a benediction for you, my fellow Christians, this morning, it's to keep it up. To keep on living like Jesus. Keep on loving like Jesus. Amen.
Don Wright has been a regular on the Wooddale witness stand for over 20 years. Unfortunately, he's only here once every 4 years because he lives and ministers in Japan. But we welcome him again to our witness stand, Don. Joanne, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having such an important part in our own ministry over the last 20 years. Our flight back to Japan is dated for June 28th. We're completing a busy year of deputation all around the United States, sharing slide presentations. We have a tradition in the witness stand of sharing slides at every opportunity we get. We'd like to share a few with you today. I'm sorry. First of all, as I said, we're going back to Japan June 28th to a ministry with our association of churches, the Rengo Association. That church association has 35 people, 35 churches. I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you. That's why I brought Joanne up here. So I see 35 churches. And our ministry over the next 4 years will be, rather than in one location, we'll be working with the 15 Tokyo churches in church planting, helping them plant new churches. I brought two other things I'd like to show you. Excuse me. A few things I'd like to show you. I did bring a rock from Japan, from our Tokorozawa work, and any of you would like to look at that later. Lastly, just to help you remember that there is only 0.5% in Japan who know Jesus Christ, so that you would be burdened to pray for us and the ministry in Japan, we have brought back a hair from a Japanese head. And this is the hair of a Christian. Please pray for the rights and for Japan and our ministry as we return.
As we've returned from each term over these past 20 years, we have always asked the Lord if he would indeed have us go back and exactly what he would have us do. Again, this year, as we've been on home assignment, God has confirmed that call to us that we must return to Japan, and we go with great joy. We are more convinced than ever that Japan is a needy mission field, with only 0.5% of the people there knowing Jesus Christ. And Japan is such a strategic land today. As you know, they're on top in economics and in trade and in finance and in education in many ways. And yet they are lost without Jesus Christ. And we consider it a real privilege to be there and to tell them that there is a real eternal purpose in life, and it is not materialism. We're so thankful for the great part you have had in partnership with the Shintokurozawa Baptist Church. Kathy Griffin is here today, and we're so thankful that you sent her to be an English teacher there and for the wonderful ministry God has given her. Pray for that church. They have recently gone through a church split, and we urge you to pray for Pastor Kawata and his wife and for the faithful who remain there. It seems like an impossible situation, but we have claimed a verse from Jeremiah, Jeremiah 32:27. I am the Lord. Is anything too hard for me? Please pray that God would have the victory at the Tokorozawa Church.